Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today we are exploring the overwhelming volume of music commissioned by kings, nobles, and other influential patrons of the arts. In our Sounds of Scripture segment in Part 1, we saw how, when it came to the monarchies of the biblical record, the kings who received the Bible's highest endorsement are the same who were the greatest patrons of music. In our Backstage Banter segment, we heard from one of America's most celebrated conductors, Gerard Schwartz, talking about this patronage system in general, from ancient kings to modern benefactors. And toward the end of this half, we will hear from him again in our Classroom Corner segment, where he talks about his initiatives to educate the general public about music. But where we left off in our historical discussion was with the patronage system of the classical era and how it impacted the output of the three great composers of that era, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. At the end of Part 1, we were discussing Haydn's employment in the court of Prince Esterhazy and the prolific amount of great music that resulted from this relationship. As I mentioned in Part 1, this post not only offered Haydn economic security, the prince also encouraged Haydn to compose in the latest musical styles. Later in life, Haydn was even allowed enough freedom to live in Vienna and to travel across Europe. In the words of Haydn himself, quote, "My prince was content with all my efforts and gave me his approval. As leader of the orchestra, I could experiment, take note of what made an impression and what lessened it, and so could improve by adding, trimming, and taking risks. I was isolated from the rest of the world. There was no one nearby to bother me or distract me from my chosen path, and so I was obliged to become original." Unquote. One of the great examples of a piece composed for the Esterhazys has a humorous component, and therefore a bit of a risk, too, I should add. Haydn composed his Symphony No. 45 in 1772, and it became known as the Farewell Symphony. It is called that because it was written while the prince and all his staff were at their summer palace a day's journey away in rural Hungary. This kept the musicians from their families, and the stay was going longer than anyone expected. The homesick musicians asked Haydn to intercede for them, and Haydn, instead of addressing the issue with the prince directly, hinted at it in a not-so-subtle way in the fourth movement of this symphony. The fourth and final movement of a symphony would usually be lively and powerful, which it is at first. Haydn slows things down in the final section, making the orchestration thinner and thinner. Now that would have caught the prince's attention, no doubt, as he was accustomed to how symphonies usually ended. What's more, Haydn had some choreography planned for this conclusion that each musician, when finished with his part, was to blow out the candle on his music stand and leave the performance area until there were just two performers left, one of them being Haydn. The prince seemed to pick up on the hint, and the entourage headed home the next day. Here is the famous fourth movement from Haydn's Farewell Symphony, performed by Charles McCarris and the Orchestra of St. Luke's, and you hear how it starts as a fast movement, but then you can hear the slow conclusion and the orchestration getting thinner and thinner, musicians essentially leaving the symphony before it was completely finished. Here's the Farewell Symphony final movement. Thank you. That's one of the most clever conclusions in all of music history, I think. That was the end of Haydn's Farewell Symphony, Symphony No. 45, performed by the Orchestra of St. Luke's, and it was an example of a symphony commissioned by a royal of European history, and in this case, Haydn took a risk by humorously hinting to the prince of the Esterházy court that the musicians wanted to go home, as they had been staying at the Esterházy summer palace longer than they were expecting. In that surprisingly slow conclusion, you heard the orchestration getting thinner and thinner. That's because Haydn had written it that way, plus the instrumentalists, once done, were instructed to leave the performance as soon as their part was over. The prince, apparently, after seeing this and hearing this, got the hint, and they left the day after this farewell symphony was performed for him. The Esterházy patronage of Franz Joseph Haydn yielded wonderful musical results. The other two main composers of the classical era, Mozart and Beethoven, also created great music as a result of this patronage system. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart wrote much of his great music for the court of Emperor Joseph II. The emperor appointed him as court composer in 1787 in order to keep Mozart from leaving Vienna, and for the court, Mozart completed such works as his last several string quartets, other quintets and various chamber music, the clarinet concerto, his late piano concertos, among other major works. One of those piano concertos that Mozart wrote while in the employ of the emperor was later nicknamed the Coronation Concerto. This piano concerto, number 26, received its nickname because it was performed on the occasion of Leopold II's coronation as Holy Roman Emperor in October 1790. This is the end of the third movement of Piano Concerto No. 26, K537. It's performed here by Alicia Della Rocha with the English Chamber Orchestra, Sir Colin Davis conducting. In addition to Emperor Joseph II, another noble, a Baron Gottfried von Swieten, was particularly interested in financing Mozart's career. He was a government official who served the Austrian Empire during the 18th century, and he met Mozart when the young composer was only 11 years old. The Baron helped Mozart throughout his life, even helping the Mozart family after Wolfgang's death by making some of the funeral arrangements and a couple years later staging a performance of Mozart's Requiem. Baron von Swieten was also a big supporter of the next composer of our discussion, Ludwig von Beethoven. Beethoven, known for revolutionizing the genre of the symphony, dedicated his first symphony to the Baron. Another noble benefactor of Beethoven was the Russian ambassador in Vienna, Prince Razumovsky. He commissioned three of Beethoven's string quartets, those known as the Razumovsky Quartets, and Beethoven even incorporated Russian themes into two of those three quartets in order to please his Russian patron. Beethoven's greatest patron, however, was Archduke Rudolf, the youngest son of Emperor Leopold II and the youngest brother of Emperor Franz. Rudolf provided Beethoven with access to the highest salons in Vienna. He was a great patron of the arts and a skilled pianist and composer himself. Because the Archduke took such great financial care of the composer, Beethoven dedicated the greatest number of compositions to Rudolf, more than to anyone else. Such works as his Missa Solemnis, his Grosse Fuga, his Violin Sonata No. 10, his fourth and fifth piano concertos, the fifth piano concerto being nicknamed the Emperor, and three of his late piano sonatas. One of those piano sonatas was nicknamed Les Adieux, a farewell, depicting the time the Archduke had to leave Vienna because of Napoleon's attack on the city. Beethoven gave each movement of this three-movement sonata a programmatic title, meaning it was to depict something specific rather than each movement just being titled after its tempo. The first movement is titled Das Lebewohl, meaning the farewell. You actually see Beethoven having written in this three-syllable word over the three opening notes that he wrote, Lebewohl. The second movement is titled Abwesenheit, or The Absence, written while the Archduke was in exile. Then Beethoven did not compose the final movement, Das Wiedersehen, or The Return, until after the Archduke returned to Vienna in 1810. But let's continue hearing this first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 26 in E-flat, the Lebewohl movement. Here it is performed by pianist Arthur Rubinstein. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music for Monarchs, and we are exploring the vast volume of music that was commissioned from history's great composers by kings, nobles, and other influential patrons of the arts. That was the first movement of Ludwig van Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 26 in E-flat, performed by Arthur Rubinstein. It was a piece Beethoven nicknamed Les Adieux, and it was dedicated to his greatest benefactor, Archduke Rudolf, son of Emperor Leopold II. That movement was written to depict the farewell of the Archduke, who left Vienna when Napoleon's armies attacked the city. Let's move now into the Romantic era, where the composer Felix Mendelssohn wrote a historically significant work for the King of Prussia. If you heard our very first episode, when we talked overtures, you know that a 17-year-old Mendelssohn wrote a concert overture embodying the spirit of Shakespeare's play A Midsummer Night's Dream. Well, Mendelssohn ended up writing what's called incidental music for the entire play, at the request of Frederick William IV of Prussia. The Prussian king had attended a play where he heard Mendelssohn's incidental music. Incidental music is that written to accompany a play. Say there's a place in the action where music naturally would be heard, like at a wedding, so the company would need a composer to write music for that section of the play. The king was so enamored with Mendelssohn's music that he asked the composer to write more music for his favorite plays. One of the king's favorite plays was Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Well, Mendelssohn already had music that would work as the overture to that play. This play actually has a wedding in it, and Mendelssohn's music for the wedding march became so popular that it has been used as the recessional music at countless Western weddings ever since. But I hope to save this movement for another episode. I'll let you imagine what it sounds like right now. Let's listen to the short scherzo movement from the play's incidental music, again commissioned by the King of Prussia when Mendelssohn was 34 years old. Here it is, performed by Jane Glover and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Thank you. That was the scherzo movement of Felix Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream incidental music, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra with Jane Glover conducting. It was an example of the vast array of music that has come about as a result of a royal commission, that is, a king asked a composer to write it. Moving later into the Romantic era, we come upon another composer whose output was greatly affected by a couple of influential benefactors. One of these benefactors wasn't a royal per se, but rather was a woman who was influential through her wealth. Nadezhda von Meck, a wealthy widow of a railroad tycoon, was fond of Peter Tchaikovsky's music. She arranged to give him a regular monthly allowance so he could compose full time. The peculiar aspect of this relationship is that Madame von Meck had only one stipulation. She and Tchaikovsky were never to meet face to face. They did, however, correspond regularly via letters for about 14 years. Tchaikovsky dedicated his famous Fourth Symphony to her. Here is Claudio Abbado conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in the end of the final movement of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. That was Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, the final movement, performed by Claudio Abbado and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and it was a piece dedicated to one of Tchaikovsky's greatest benefactors, Nadezhda von Meck, a wealthy widow who agreed to sponsor Tchaikovsky so that he could compose full-time as long as they never met face-to-face. It was a relationship that lasted about 14 years. More properly along the lines of our show's title today, Music for Monarchs, Tchaikovsky also lived under three Russian emperors. He took commissions from Alexander II, though he was not personally acquainted with him. Alexander II commissioned Tchaikovsky to provide musical accompaniment for a staged tableau celebrating the 25th anniversary of Alexander's reign. He finished the job only to be informed that the performance had been canceled. He was also asked to write music for the opening of a cathedral in Moscow. This cathedral was built in commemoration of the 1812 victory over Napoleon. For the cathedral's consecration on May 26, 1883, Tchaikovsky wrote the famous 1812 overture. The next emperor of Russia, Alexander III, was also a patron of Peter Tchaikovsky's. Tchaikovsky wrote the coronation march and a cantata for Alexander III's enthronement in 1881. For these pieces, Tchaikovsky received a diamond ring from the emperor. Here is that famous festival coronation march, performed by the Slovak Philharmonic Orchestra with conductor Richard Heyman. Thank you.
conductor Gerard Schwartz, and you're listening to Music for Life on KPCG.
And on today's episode, titled Music for Monarchs, we are exploring the impact that kings, nobles, and other influential patrons of the arts have had on the musical repertoire that is the overwhelming volume of music that they commissioned from history's great composers. That was a piece commissioned by and composed for Alexander III, Emperor of Russia, for his coronation in 1881. Another Romantic composer whose output benefited largely from a royal patronage was Richard Wagner. Ludwig II, King of Bavaria, was one of Wagner's greatest patrons. He provided a place for Wagner to live in Switzerland, where the composer could finish his opera Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg, which premiered in Munich in 1868. Wagner was also able to continue working on his epic four-opera ring cycle as well, and the king demanded special previews of the first two productions of that opera cycle in Munich in 1869 and 1870. Without the king's support, Wagner would not have been able to complete the ring cycle or his final opera, Parsifal. The king was responsible for sponsoring the premieres for many of Wagner's operas. Ludwig II also helped finance Wagner's own opera house in Bayreuth, a venue devoted exclusively, to this day, to the performance of Wagner's operas. Let's hear a little bit of that stirring overture of Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg. Here is Claudio Abbado again, conducting in this recording the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. That was a little bit of the overture to Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg by Richard Wagner. Wagner was able to finish that opera because of the patronage of the King of Bavaria, Ludwig II. Ludwig had provided a Swiss residence for Wagner to finish the opera. As we continue to discuss the music that came as a result of these rulers and nobles who shaped music history with their patronage, let's move now into the 20th century. As we heard in part one, in our interview with Gerard Schwartz, this system is still in effect today, though it may not be as commonly done through the commission of a monarch, but it is done by the elite, wealthy, and influential patrons of the arts. And as Maestro Schwartz said, in some cases, it's an institution that's sponsoring the commission. An early 20th century example of this was a conductor and composer himself, Serge Koussevitzky, used his considerable influence at the Boston Symphony to champion contemporary music and commission many of the great works that were written in that part of the century. For the 50th anniversary of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Koussevitzky commissioned Prokofiev's Symphony No. 4, Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms, and Maurice Ravel's Piano Concerto in G. He also commissioned Ravel's orchestral arrangement of Modest Mussorgsky's 1874 piano suite Pictures at an Exhibition, which quickly became the most famous orchestration of the work. But let's listen to a short movement from Ravel's Piano Concerto. Here is Jean-Yves Thibaudet with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, Charles Dutoit conducting. This is the third and final movement. Thank you. That was the finale to Ravel's Piano Concerto in G, and it was a piece commissioned by the Boston Symphony Orchestra's philanthropic and influential conductor, Serge Koussevitzky. We are exploring the impact that kings, nobles, and other influential patrons of the arts have had on music, particularly the vast volume of music that they commissioned from history's great composers. In the 20th and 21st centuries, we find major organizations like symphony orchestras acting as the benefactors to contemporary composers, commissioning new works, much like history's monarchs and aristocrats would. Another symphony orchestra organization active in commissioning music from modern composers is the Nashville Symphony. It regularly commissions music for each new concert season, 1 to 3 new compositions usually, and performs these new works for Middle Tennessee audiences. This is how the symphony works to promote new American orchestral music. Recent commissions include Ben Folds' Piano Concerto in 2014, Edgar Meyer's Double Concerto for Violin and Double Bass in 2013, and Bela Fleck's The Impostor Concerto for Banjo and Orchestra in 2011. So this, as Maestro Schwartz told us in the first half, is a system that is still spawning much new music. Now, speaking of Maestro Schwartz, let's get into our Classroom Corner segment, where we usually explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. Today, though, we're not going to discuss music education for young people as much. We're going to discuss the education of the general public. Thinking of how this relates to the episode, we still live in a time when leaders or major institutions of society will commission compositions from composers, but nowadays, a large benefactor of fine art music is the average concert goer, the ticket holder, men and women of the general public. So it certainly is in music's best interest to ensure they are educated, even if they weren't when they were young. A major figure in the music industry involved in this effort is conductor Gerard Schwartz, who we heard from earlier in the show. During that interview, I asked him about his all-star orchestra and its efforts to educate the public about music.
You know, I was music director in Seattle for 26 years, and when I got there, they didn't have a home. We did no educational work. It was all cut out because of the finances. Now you think about public education systems, and as soon as there's a problem, they cut out the arts. Well, arts institutions cut out education when there are problems. You should almost think you should do the opposite. Anyway,
right.
So when I was there, we began a huge education program, which was very successful. We built a new hall. We went from 5,000 to 40,000 subscribers. I mean, it was an incredible time. And what I really wanted to do was have an effect, if I can be so bold, on society to appreciate classical music. I believe that if people were involved in classical music, we'd have a better world. We know, without question, that when high school kids study music, they get better grades, they are more apt to graduate on time and go to college. They socially hang out with people who are focused on culture and education rather than with so many high school kids, where can I get a fake ID and get a beer? You know, because it's a different mentality. And it's really quite extraordinary. And there are examples all over the country of how this has been effective. So with that in mind, when I left Seattle, I said, I really want to somehow devote the rest of my life, when I'm not conducting and composing and writing, to education, to really bring this great art form to people. And there were three areas that needed work. First of all, you have to expose people. If they've never heard a work of Mozart, probably they won't like it just because they don't know it. Or Mozart, I don't know Mozart, I don't want to go. Because they haven't been exposed. Then, if they're not at all educated, when they do go, some people are touched by it and, wow, it's exciting. And other people say, what's going on up there? What's that instrument, a violin? What's a violin? You know what I mean? It's that basic. Mm-hmm. And the third issue is that it can be expensive. Investing money in going to a concert, for what? Why? Why should I go to a concert? So my idea was to try to create an institution that would be the conduit for people to be able to go and appreciate great music and eventually go to concerts, hopefully. So I thought, this is what I have to do. I have to do it with television, because everybody has a television. And if you do it with public television, everybody gets it for free. You don't have to have a cable to get public television. And there's public television in the whole country. And then I wanted to have an educational outlet. I wasn't sure what it was going to be, but I wanted that desperately. And I wanted to make the TV shows that were for television, not concerts. So the All-Star Orchestra, which is made up of, and I also wanted it to be an orchestra that wasn't aligned with any specific city. Okay. It wasn't a New York orchestra, a Philadelphia orchestra, a Seattle orchestra, a Houston. We had players from 30 major orchestras in the country. Great players. And the atmosphere is just incredible. And we get together once a year, once every 2 years for a week, and we record television shows. No audience, no concerts, television shows. They go on public television, and about 80% of the country takes it. They don't have to, and they do. In some cities, the radios have been sensational because they're only an hour long. It's a little education, and we play the pieces through, basically. But I really wanted to get an association with what I consider to be the greatest online education resource probably in the world, the Khan Academy, K-H-A-N. Sal Khan started this to educate kids in math and science. You go on the Khan Academy website, and the first thing that pops up is math, grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4, grade 5, algebra, algebra 2, trigonometry, and so forth. Then there's science. I think I'm third. I do now all the music for the Khan Academy. Mm. It's been about a year now. We have reached 2.5 million students.
Wow.
So think about that.
Yeah.
2.5 million people of age, many ages, but they're all students,
sure,
are learning about music. And we divide it up into three areas. One is fundamentals of music. Reading notes, knowing rhythms, clefs, sharps and flats, ledger lines. You know, we're developing it. We have 20 lessons of that so far. We'll have 100, probably, or more. So that's music theory. Then we have a whole section on the instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, you know, what's that instrument that looks like an oboe, but it's a little bigger, and you look under oboe, then the next thing that comes up is English horn. You press that, and the solo English horn player from the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra teaches you about the English horn.
Mm-hmm.
Or the first trumpet of the Philadelphia Orchestra teaches you about the trumpet. Or the first oboe from the Boston Symphony teaches you about the oboe. And then I give little talks and others about the actual pieces. So an analysis. It's not at all dumbing down, but at the same time, I'm not esoteric. I'm not talking about augmented seventh chords.
Mm-hmm. It's more surface level analysis.
It's a little deeper than surface, but okay, not musicologically oriented as a theorist would.
Right.
For example, I just finished the one on the Mahler second. You want to know about the Mahler second, you put that on the first moment. You'll learn about Mahler. You'll learn about the atmosphere that was going on, what he was doing, you know, a little history about the piece. And then I go through the piece. I say, this is what happens at the beginning. This is the first thing. This is the second thing. I give some conducting lessons on this site. And the idea is that we are not trying to replace teachers. We're trying to supplement what they offer.
Right.
So if you have an orchestra in school and one of the kids just doesn't understand rhythm, all you got to do is say, go to the Khan Academy and look under the note values and you'll learn. You know, mm-hmm. In other words, the teacher doesn't have to keep 80 kids waiting in the orchestra saying, oh, that's a half note, gets two beats, you know,
right,
that kind of thing. So this is really something that I'm absolutely 100% dedicated to. We also have so far on the Khan Academy little lectures about maybe five or six pieces by living American composers. They and I talk about their pieces. So you hear a little short piece by Augusta Reed Thomas, and I talk a little bit, and she talks a lot about her piece, what it was about. I mean, you have a connection to the real
right
composers. So for me, this is really among the most important things that I'm doing, and I'm trying to do over these many years now. I will try to do one piece by every major composer. You know, you do one Beethoven, we did Beethoven the fifth, and one Tchaikovsky, we did the fourth, Shostakovich, we did the fifth, and so forth. We haven't done most of the composers. You know, when I started doing all this, I didn't know I'd have the Khan Academy, but I had the vision of what I wanted, and we just recorded everything. We recorded interviews with everybody. I mean, it was really interesting that we were able to then find the outlet, and Khan, you know, there were a lot of people who wanted to do the music for them. And they chose us because we have a history of it. I have a history of doing it. Interestingly, we don't get paid for that. Hmm. And they don't even help us raise money for it, which is really fascinating because really it's ours. It's our material that we give to them. And then they just do such a fabulous job with it. So for me, it's a never ending, as you can imagine.
Right.
In reading music, I got up to half steps, so I do the chromatic scale. Well, I haven't done a whole step. I haven't done a major chord. I haven't done a minor chord. I haven't done major minor scales. I haven't done thirds, fourths, fifths, sixths, sevenths, ninths. I mean, I haven't done anything. And just doing it, someone like me, who's educating on a, let's call it a elementary level, how do you read music? Okay, I'll ask you. So you say, okay, how do you read music? What's the first thing you have to do? You have to do a staff, five parallel lines. Well, then what? You have to have the clef. So you have to do, what's a clef? Well, and then after you have the clef, then you put the notes on the clef. And how many clefs do you do? Well, we do treble and bass. I do a little bit of tenor and alto. And then you look at a score, mm-hmm. and you see, okay, the Schumann Renner Symphony, the trombone is alto trombone and alto clef, tenor trombone and tenor clef, and bass trombone and bass clef. So everything we do, we relate to music. If we're, right. if I'm talking about half notes and whole notes, I play the opening of the slow movement of the New World Symphony of Dvorak, which is all half notes and whole notes. So on the screen, you see one side of the screen where the brass players are playing this, and the other side of the screen, you see the score.
Right.
With the half notes and the whole notes. It's a thrill for me, and I do it almost every day of my life in some way or another.
And what kind of feedback or fruits are you seeing from this program already?
Well, so far, the main feedback we're getting is the numbers. 250,000 last month watched our stuff. Mm. I mean, you know, now we're working with the National Association for Music Education and their 140,000 members, and they're going to use it to supplement their educational work in the schools. So all I want to do is get it out there. I don't get paid for it, and we don't get paid. I mean, it's just, I'm a believer.
Right.
I believe it can have an impact in the world.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music for Monarchs, and we have explored the vast amount of music that has been commissioned from history's great composers by kings and nobles and other influential patrons of the arts. And in some cases, they were for actual royal occasions, as we heard. Finally, let's have our dessert for today, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition, usually some lighter fare, to end the program. Though this example is from the folk tradition, it really isn't lighter in one sense, as it's about the death of a monarch. This is called The Death of Queen Jane. This wasn't a piece commissioned by a monarch, but certainly its telling of this tale makes it pair well with today's episode, I think. And really, it's just a remarkably beautiful recording, sung by tenor Ian Bostridge and sung completely unaccompanied. Here it is, The Death of Queen Jane.
King Henry was sent for all in the time of her need. King Henry, he came in the time of her need. King Henry, he stooped and kissed her on the head. "What's the matter with my flower makes her eyes look so red?" King Henry, King Henry, will you take me to thee to pierce my side open and save my baby? "Oh no, Queen Jane, such thing shall never be. To lose my sweet flower for to save my baby." Queen Jane, she turned over and fell into a swound. Her side, it was pierced, and her baby was found. There's six followed after, and six carried her along. King Henry, he followed with his black mourning on. King Henry, he wept, and he wrung his hands till they're sore. The flower of England shall never be no more.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.